It's a pleasure to introduce again. I guess we introduced him a bit over on Shabbat, but it's a very different crowd. To introduce Ari Sivitovsky, Dr. Ari Sivitovsky lives in Beit Shemesh and who teaches at Bar Ilan in the brain science, program. He's a scientist. Got a PhD in engineering in biomedical engineering, I believe, at Case Western in Cleveland. Did a postdoc at the NIH in Washington, but that's not exactly why he's speaking. That just gives him extra credibility. But he's speaking on his many years of research into kosher animals, especially kosher exotic animals, and having been in Africa in the summer for the first time, I can tell you giraffes are absolutely beautiful. And they're really, and to shecht one is sort of a pity. We have one in the back. We'll bring it in later. That was sort of our surprise for the evening. So he's going to speak on exotic animals in the kashrut. And without further ado, a pleasure to introduce Dr. Ari Sivitovsky.
You even leave this up here. Maybe I'll join you next week or in 2 weeks. Okay. I'd like to, first of all, thank Rabbi Jay Kelman for hosting me. And actually, more than I'd like to thank his wife for hosting me over Shabbos and Torah in Motion. And I'm not sure. I'm originally from New York, so my English is not like from Beit Shemesh. It's more Brooklyn. So sometimes I speak a little fast, or if I'm talking a little bit too fast and you don't get everything, please stop me and interrupt me, and I'll try to slow down. But the other problem is that Jay asked me to speak about kosher exotic animals and birds. Usually that covers two or even three lectures. So we'll see how much we can fit in. One way to do it is to run it, the 33 at 78. So I'll start at 78, and we'll see if I lose you. Okay. What are we talking about? Kashrus of animals. We'll start with kashrus of exotic animals. Obviously, we're going to have to talk about giraffe. Giraffe is the most interesting one. But as he pointed out, giraffe is a beautiful creature. And not only is it a beautiful creature, it's really a godless abori. It's an amazing wonder of creation. And in Cleveland, when I did biomedical engineering, we did not talk about giraffes. But at the time, when I was looking at different biomedical engineering programs, I saw that in Johns Hopkins University, they have a program in biomedical engineering. And in the first year, you don't really do a lot of biomedical engineering in the beginning. You have to do all the boring basic sciences, basic physics and basic chemistry and basic calculus. So to keep the students interested in the first year, they did sort of an interesting topics course based on the engineering wonders of the giraffe. How does the giraffe breathe through that really long tube? How come the blood can get to his brain when the head is up and then he bends down to drink and his brain doesn't explode? There are all kinds of engineering wonders. So indeed, the giraffe is an engineering wonder, but that's for another time. Tonight, we're going to talk about, is the giraffe kosher? Or how do we know if the giraffe is kosher? And in general, how do we know which exotic animals are kosher? Because if I understand correctly, the Toronto kosher butcher shops are very limited. You get just, small pieces of the front of the cow. Maybe you get sheep. I doubt if you have any goat available. So it's quite limited. And the question is, how limiting is it from the halakhic perspective, and how limiting is it because of what the COR offers you? So the first thing is, how do we know which animals are kosher? So let's start over here. How would you know which animals are kosher? What would you look for? Yeah. And anything else? Split hoof and chew its cud. That sounds good. Let's go to the Chumash. And the Chumash actually talks about kosher animals in two places. In Parshas Shemini and Sefer Vayikra, and Parshas Re'eh and Sefer Devarim. And it says exactly what you said. We look over here. It tells us, Kol mafreset parsa v'shoshat shesa prasot malat ger b'behema osot tachelu. Any animal that has split hooves and chews its cud, that's what you're allowed to eat. And indeed, it's repeated exactly the same in Sefer Dvarim, and it would seem to be a very simple question. So, Rabbi, could we do it on another topic now? We'll finish with animals. Animals are very simple. Split hoof, chew its cud is kosher. There would seem to be nothing else to talk about. And, a matter of fact, it's very simple. We want to know, does it have split hooves? We check over here. Chew its cud. How do you know if it chews its cud? Well, you look, you see, is he sitting there? Are there any teachers here who teach girls high school? Because it's the same motion, how they sit in class like this, with the gum. You look, if the cow is doing that, it looks like a girl high school student, you know that it's chewing its cud. So that's it. We look to see if it's chewing its cud. You look if it has split hooves, that should be it. But the Torah even gave us more information. The Torah not only gave us the two signs, But the second time around, in Sefer Dvarim, the Torah gave us a list. After the signs, it says, Zotu behem asher tochelu, shor six avim v'se'izim, ayalu tzviv yachmor v'akov v'dishon, uta'ov v'zamer. 10 animals, 3 behemoths, 7 chayas, and that's it. Those 10 animals, we could eat. And according to the Rambam, anything that falls within this category, you don't even have, within these categories, you don't even have to check for the signs. I know that it's a type of shor, I could eat it, I know it's kosher. Now, it's important to keep in mind that halachic taxonomy and scientific taxonomy, the categorization of animals, don't necessarily go one-to-one. Meaning the Torah here gives us 10 different types of animals. But if we look at how modern science would categorize it, it might be many different species according to the modern scientific definition. Matter of fact, if we look for animals that chew their cud and have split hooves, we'll find approximately 179 different species. Now, why is that? Well, there are a whole bunch of different types of sheep. The Torah calls them all six of him. We call them merino sheep and some other kind of sheep, all kinds of different sheep. And a matter of fact, it's led to some questions today, mostly in Israel. I don't think this Mishagas has gotten to Toronto yet. But how do you define a sheep in the Torah? Well, a sheep is one of the type of animals that you could bring a korban with. And the Torah then tells you, you have to put certain parts of the animal on the mizbech. And what's unique to a sheep? No, but what part of the korban, what kind of the animal goes on the mizbech that only comes from a sheep? The tail, the alya. The sheep has a big fatty tail, looks like a big pad, hanging off the back, called an alya, and that's only in a sheep. Cows don't have it, goats don't have it. But the question is, does that define a sheep? In other words, a sheep without an alya, is that a halachic sheep? And that's become a big question today in Israel, because tzitzis, according to some people, have to be specifically from wool. Wool comes from a sheep, and most of our wool today comes from Australian sheep that don't have alyas. They just have regular old tails. And so the question is that a sheep or is that not a sheep? Most people will say, yes, that's a sheep. A sheep for a korban needs an alya. But a sheep to be a sheep, it could have a tail or it could have an alya. So again, the Torah's definition, the Torah's taxonomy is different than modern taxonomy. And today, all 179 of these would seem to be kosher. They have split hooves and chew their cud. Okay, so we saw that in the Chumash we have very clear signs. Split hoof, chew its cud, a list of 10 animals. Where could we have any questions? Why might somebody wonder, is a giraffe kosher? Is a kudu kosher? Why might there be a question? So the first issue we have to talk about is Mesorah. Tradition, you know, like fiddler in the roof. And the question is, do I need a tradition for an animal to be kosher? If I do, I have a problem. Bison, for example, which what you guys here in this hemisphere call buffalo, but it's really not buffalo. Bison, like you have in the western U.S., is a kosher. Well, if you need a Mesorah, if you need a tradition, you're going to be in trouble. Because there weren't a lot of Jews here 400 years ago, 500 years ago. There can't really be a tradition about bison. But why would you even need a Mesorah? Again, the Torah told us, split hoof, Jewish cud. It would seem you don't need a Mesorah. Or so it would seem. Let's see. After the Chumash, we go to the Mishnah. The Mishnah, which talks about kosher animals, is very straightforward. It tells you, Simani behem v'chayet nemru min haTorah. You want to know what's kosher? The Mishnah says, the signs of kosher animals are in the Torah. It doesn't even list them. The Mishnah assumes that you know Chumash. Okay, but now if we go to the Shulchan Aruch, and for this we're going to have to pay a little attention, there are two different sections in the Shulchan Aruch we're going to look at now. In Yoredeya, Siman Ayin Tet, section 79, it tells us about which animals are kosher and which are not. It tells you, Simoni behem v'chayin, it's parshu b'torah, v'hem shnei simanim, malegeru m'prasases tukot. The signs for a kosher animal are in the Torah, split hoof, and chew its cud. And then, it goes on a little more detail, we'll get back to that later. That was section 79. If we go to section 80, section 80 starts telling us how to distinguish a behemah from a chaya. Why do I care if it's a behemah, which means a domesticated animal, and a chaya, which is a non-domesticated animal? Well, there are a whole bunch of halachic differences. For example, as I said a few minutes ago, probably your butcher shops here mostly sell the front half of the cow. Why does it have only the front half of the cow? Because cows have in the hind quarter something called chelev, a type of forbidden fat, which is very difficult to remove. And therefore, we just sell the whole hind quarter off to the non-Jews. In a chaya, which we'll see in a minute what a chay is, a non-domesticated animal, the chaylev, those fats are permitted. So it's an important distinction. I want to know if it's a behema, in which case the chaylev is prohibited, or is it a chaya, in which case the chaylev is permitted. Another difference, mitzvah of kisui adam, after you shecht an animal, if it's a chaya, if it's a non-domesticated animal, you have to cover the blood. There's a mitzvah of kisui adam. If it's a behema, there's no mitzvah of kisui adam. So again, very important to know if it's a behema or a chaya. How do I distinguish? And it's not only if it was raised on a farm, it's domesticated. If it's, you know, if I hunted it, it's non-domesticated. It has to do with the type of animal. So the Shulchan Aruch tells you that v'chachamim natnu simanim. The sages gave us signs to know if it's a behema or a chaya, mipi ha-shmua, that this was a tradition. There's no indication in the Torah about these signs. Bekarnoteha, regarding the horn, the antlers, you know, the thing on its head. Im heim befutzalot, if it's branched, in Hebrew there's only one word. In Hebrew it's karnayim. In English we have two words, horns and antlers. So he says, im heim befutzalot, if it's branched, meaning antlers, then vadai chaya tohoru. Then it's a definite chaya. You could eat the chaylev. You do mitzvah kisei adam. V'im einam afutzalot. If it's horns, then tzoch shir behem shlosha simanim. Then there are three other signs that I need in those horns to know if it's a behema or a chaya. I'm not going to read those what those signs are, because probably the most important commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the Shach, said, if you're interested, take a look at the Beis Yosef. I'm not going to explain either. It's too complicated. We don't use those signs anymore, the Shach says. What does he say? How do we know what to do? Tradition. I can't explain these signs to you. These signs we don't use anymore. If you're interested on a theoretical level about the signs and the horns, go look in the Beis Yosef. But we have Mesoret. That's all we have. Now the question is, what is the Shach talking about? When the Shach said that we need a tradition, what is he referring to? Anybody want to... No, we're talking about animals here. What do we need a Masoret for? What do we need a tradition for?
If it was eaten generation to generation.
If it was eaten, exactly. A Masoret that your parents ate it and your grandparents ate it. And what am I going to do with that tradition? What do I need the tradition for? For what? To carry on. What? But what aspect? That it's kosher. Okay, what do you say? Or if it's a behemoth, those are the two possibilities. One possibility is what you said. I need a tradition to know the essential question, the fundamental question, is it a kosher species or not? And like you said, if the previous generations ate it, we could eat it. And what did you say? The other option is no, to know if it's kosher, split hooves and short cud. What do I need a Masorah for? To know if it's a behemoth or a chaya. Is the chaylev permitted or prohibited? Well, it would seem to me, not like you guys, sorry. It would seem to me, this is in section 80. And remember, I pointed out to you, we're looking at two different sections of the Shulchan Aruch. Ayin Tet 79 is about the essence of if it's kosher or not. 80, Pei, is about if it's a behema or a chaya. That's where the Shach mentions about tradition, about Mesorah. So it would seem to me, very simple, that he's talking about distinction between behema and chaya. However, it seems a lot of people thought like you guys, that he's talking about the essence of it, if it's kosher or not. In order to counter that, the Prima Gadam, who was a little bit later than the Shach, says, don't be mistaken. Don't think that he's saying we need the Masorah to know if it's kosher. No, that we have signs. We need a Masorah to know if it's a behema or a chaya. That's what the Prima Gadam says. However, a few years later, came probably the most important posek in the last 200 years in Lithuania, the Chayodim, and in the Chochmas Adam, he wrote, exactly like you guys said, he said, we only eat what we have a tradition on. If it's kosher or not kosher, nothing to do with behema or chaya, the Chochmas Adam said, like you, we need a tradition. Did our ancestors eat this animal? It's kosher. If they didn't eat it, it's not kosher. So we have here a major machlokas. Chochmas Adam says, you need a tradition to know whether it's kosher or not. Prima Gadam says, that's not what the Shach says at all. We just need a tradition to know if it's a behema or a chaya. Now, most people understand it the way the Prima Gadam did. It's here in Simon Pei. It's talking about the signs of the antlers, the horns. Yes?
If you don't have a tradition that it's a domesticated animal,
yes,
and you have the signs of its kosher, doesn't that mean by default that it's a wild animal?
No, it could be a kosher domesticated animal. Why would it be by default? Because if I have split hoof and Schwartz card, that tells me it's kosher. Now I need to know, is it a behemoth or a chaya? So for that,
Everybody says you need a tradition. In other words, you have, there are kosher domesticated and kosher non-domesticated. What do you mean? If it has antlers or horns?
Antlers.
If it has antlers, then it's for sure chaya. We're a home free. If it has horns, there I need these signs. And for that, the Shach says, we only have tradition. But the question is, do I need the tradition also to know if it's kosher? And that the Chacham HaSadim said yes. Now this became a halach lemaisa, a practical question, soon after the founding of the State of Israel. Soon after the founding of the State of Israel, who was the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel? Rabbi Herzog. Rabbi Herzog was first chief rabbi. He receives a letter from the rabbinate in France. And they ask him, they say, listen, we would like to start importing a type of animal called a zebu. And we'd like to start shechting, and we want to know if it's kosher. And Rabbi Herzog wrote back and says, well, does it have split hooves? Sure, it's cud. If yes, it's kosher. If not, it's not kosher. And that's what he wrote to them. He said, there's no need for a tradition. We have over here, you know, in the Shach, only talking about behemoth versus chaya, but to know if it's kosher, no need for a tradition. That was Rav Herzog's ruling. But unlike the situation today, back then, the chief rabbinate and the Haredi establishment got along very well. Rav Herzog had a very good relationship with the Chazon Ish. And Rav Herzog said, you know, here's the question I got. He sent it along to the Chazon Ish as well. The Chazon Ish responded that absolutely not. The Zebu was not acceptable. We need a tradition to know if it's kosher. If we don't have a tradition, it's not kosher. Again, the Chazon Ish said, the most important posek for us Lithuanian Jews, and if you're a Lithuanian Jew, there are no other Jews. For us Lithuanian Jews, the most important posek was the Chacham HaSadim, and he says you need tradition, and that's the halacha. There was a back and forth in letters between Rav Herzog and the Chazon Ish. They got a little bitter. Rav Herzog said, anybody who says you need a tradition and you don't rely on the signs is over on the prohibition of Baal Tosif, adding to the Torah. And the Chazon Ish wrote back and he said, and you're breaking tradition by not following the Chacham HaSadim, and it's not kosher. And they continued to get along. It was a Mecham Toshel Torah, but it was a very strong debate. This came up again very recently. About 6 years ago, someone discovered that the majority of meat in the land of Israel comes from South America. And the majority of the South American animals that are shechted are hybrids between zebu and standard cattle. And if the zebu is not kosher, his offspring is not kosher either. And of course, this happened a week before Pesach. The news broke. And for like 2 days, you know, everybody was, you know, is all the meat kosher, not kosher? And then slowly all of the kosher establishments decided that the meat was okay, with the exception of Sheiris. Sheiris is under a Rebbe Yoshev, and for a short time, Sheiris said it wasn't kosher. That year, I don't know what they did, and then it all went under the carpet again. Everybody forgot about it. The meat's still coming from South America. It's still zebu. But halach l'maisha, it's very interesting. You have on one side the Chacham HaSadim and the Chazon Ish, who are emphatic that one needs a tradition just to know the essence if it's kosher or not kosher. You have on the other side the Prima Gadol, the Piskei Tshuva, Kafa Chaim, the vast majority of Yemenite and Sephardi poskim, and even other Ashkenazi poskim, for example, Rav Vosner. We'll get back to Rav Vosner in a minute, because I just want to bring up why it also was a practical question here, not in Israel, but in the Western Hemisphere. The question is about the American bison. I don't know how it is in Toronto. It seems that in the U.S., the Jews have too much free time, too much money, you know, you need more things. So about 15 or 20 years ago, the question came up about the American bison, what you commonly call the buffalo, and is it kosher? And again, if you're going to hold like the Chazon Ish that you need a Masorah, there can't be a Masorah on it. If you hold you just need signs, split hoof, chew its cud, which it has, it's then kosher. So the question came up. It was discussed by the OU, the Star K. Eventually, again, I don't know, it was about 15 years ago, they all started shechting it. It was under a lot of reliable hashkachas. But then some guy in Brooklyn decided to investigate the question, and he came out with an entire pamphlet called Kuntres Kashrus HaBizon, a pamphlet about the kashrus of the buffalo. In this pamphlet, he goes through everything that I've discussed. He talks about the Shach and the Prima Gadol and the Chazon Ish. He brings all those sources. He understood that although Brooklyn is a very nice place, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, and he wrote a letter to some of the poskim in Eretz Yisrael. And the most interesting of the letters that he received was from Rav Vosner. Rav Vosner is a very important posek who lives in Bnei Brak, the town of the Chazon Ish. And Rav Vosner can't simply dismiss the Chazon Ish's position. The Chazon Ish was the posek of Bnei Brak, and to this day he's followed in many areas in Bnei Brak. And what Rav Vosner wrote to him is that indeed it would seem to be a das yachad. It would seem to be not simple understanding of the Shach. And he says, therefore, you guys in America, don't worry about it. You don't have to worry about the Chazon Ish's position. You could eat bison. If you'd ask me what we should do here in Eretz Yisrael, and in particularly in Bnei Brak, I'll have to think about that a little more. But for you guys in America, it's okay. You can have your bison. So that was the psak. And then bison was now accepted by all of the kashrus establishments in the U.S. I assume Canada as well. Yeah. Ah, well, we haven't discussed if it's behemoth or chaya.
By your logic, it would be.
Why?
Because it meets the classification of not knowing. We don't have a tradition of it. We weren't here in North America.
No, so if there's no tradition, it means that I could treat it as kosher if it has the signs. But I can't treat it as a definite behemoth or a definite chaya. I need a tradition to tell me, is it a behemoth or a chaya? I have no tradition either way. So I have to go to Chumrah in both ways. Meaning the chaylev is asr, but I have to kisir dam. So it's both. I can't, in other words, you can't have the hind quarter. The only thing that you do get hind quarter in America, actually, I don't know here, but a deer. They say, oh, you shechs deer. Oh, I think it now switched to chafkei. I think it's the chafkei now in Musakan Farms. And there they do nikra on the hind quarter. Anyway, so the bison was now acceptable by everybody, all the kashrus organizations in America. And so we had to go out and see this. You know, this is an interesting thing. I assume you guys also, when you first heard about it, all booked a flight to the slaughterhouse. I don't know exactly where it is. I grew up in New York. It was west of the Hudson and quite west. I don't know exactly how far. This is somewhere near North Dakota we were heading. And here's the bison. Those of you who have seen bison, they're quite big. And okay, this is a bison ready for the slaughter. This is my friend Ari Greenspan, who I do all this research with. Here's a bison coming into the pen, and when he charges in, you really, really pray that metal holds up, because they come charging in. Come on. Okay, they're very powerful animals. I don't think you have a clue. Their body to brain ratio is not very big. I don't know. What? No, the body to brain, correct. The brain to brain, okay. Okay, wait, hold on. And this is that the one we just saw? Okay. Now, I don't know why it goes sideways. I apologize. Okay, those who don't want to look, we're going to see the shkita now. So he's coming in. A thing holds up his neck on the bottom. And the main point of this is exactly what you pointed out, that we have to go the chumrah both ways. The chaylev is going to be prohibited, but because it's a suffix, you have to do kisir adam without a bracha. And so what you're going to see him do right before the shkita, he takes a big bucket that has dirt in it, he pushes the bucket under the neck and shechs it, and the blood flows into the bucket with the dirt. Okay, now he's shaving the animal. You asked if we need sound. It's important for this, right? Okay. This was OU. I didn't check it. This is the OU shkita. Okay, this is the most important thing. You see the bucket that he puts underneath right before the shkita. He's going to put the bucket full of dirt underneath so that way when it bleeds out, which we're going to skip, you'll see the blood flows into the dirt. Okay, I mentioned the Zebu, and I mentioned that the Zebu question had been in the 1950s. The Zebu question then came up a few years ago. When the question came up, Zebu is this guy right here, this kind of cow with the bump, the hump on the back that I mentioned. This, by the way, is a picture that I took in Israel, and you can see here are regular cows, here's Zebu. They're quite similar. The distinctive feature of the Zebu is this hump on its back. There were many, many articles written at the time about it. I'm not going to add anything except for one small point. When you visit Israel, I think it's very important to visit all these old shuls that you find all over the country, in Beit Alpha, in Tveria, in Yericho, and you have all over shuls that are 1,500 years old with mosaic floors. And there's a lot you can learn from those mosaic floors. So, for example, in the Beit Alpha Shul, which is about 1,500 years old, you have this picture on the floor. There's no question in my mind that this is a zebu because of this hump. Why is that a significance? It doesn't give us a Masorah. That doesn't give us a tradition of a zebu, because again, a tradition has to be continuous, and there's not a continuous tradition here. Nor does it indicate that it's kosher just because it's on the mosaic floor. There are also eagles and lions on mosaic floors. Two things I want to say, that's one of them. But it does tell us two things. One is that the zebu seemed to have been known in the land of Israel 1,500 years ago. So unlike what was assumed by Rav Herzog and the Chazon Ish, that this is a new species that they want to import from Madagascar, it seems to have existed in the land of Israel. And I think that there's no question that the artist was highlighting the split hooves over here. And if that's true, it's an indication that they were treating it as kosher. Now, again, that's not a Masorah. It doesn't prove it's kosher. But I think it's an interesting indication that it existed in the land and that they probably did treat it as kosher. Up north in the Galilee. Near Beit Shan. But it's worth going to see these shuls. The Beit Alpha shul is right next to Kibbutz Beit Alpha. It's right near Sachnin, not so close. And Gan HaShlosha, it's a national park. It's a quick stop when you go visit. It's about a 15-minute stop. There's nothing else there but the shul. In other words, they were building on the kibbutz, and they found this mosaic. They built a national park around it. You come in, you see the mosaic, you see a movie about it. But it's well worth, I think, visiting these shuls. Yeah. Correct. No, this is from India. This is India, man. I guess correct. This is from India. But there are all kinds of cattle. And the question is, when the Torah says bakar, what does it mean? Does it mean only, you know, one type of cattle, or it means everything that we call cattle, or is it even more than that? Again, halachic taxonomy is very different. The halacha is that you can't use a horn of a cow for a shofar, right? How do you define a cow? How about the horn of a bison? Horn of a buffalo? Horn of a yak? Is that close enough? In other words, so again, halachic taxonomy may not be the same, and it's not obvious. Rav Yaakov Emden has a tshuva about the buffalo horn and the shofar. So he says, better not to use it. But is it for sure the same as a cow? It depends on the halacha. If we're talking about korbanos, I have no question that a yak and a cow are not the same thing, and that you can't bring a yak for a korban when you need to bring a cow. When we're talking about for shofar, maybe they are close enough. So again, taxonomy is very hard to know, and it's very dependent on the halacha we're talking about. It's not the same for every halacha. The Chazon Ish talks about kelayim regarding esrog and other citrus fruits. And the Chazon Ish says, he's mesupuk, he's in doubt. It could be, he says, it's not kelayim. You could plant them together. That an orange and an esrog are the same species as far as kelayim. But there's no question that they're not the same species regarding the mitzvah of Abraminim. Then I need an esrog, and an orange is obviously not good enough. So the question of taxonomy depends very much on what halacha you're talking about. Okay, that was zebu. So we've talked about American bison. We talked about zebu. I want to just mention a little bit about the story of the water buffalo. This is really what's called the buffalo. When you talk about buffalo, when the halacha talks about buffalo, it's the European water buffalo. This is a little water buffalo. This is his last day. This is Rabbi Levinger. You've probably heard of Rabbi Levinger. He's the famous kashrus expert. He's written the book called Mazon Kasher Menachaya. This Zohar Amar, who, if you guys are lucky, one day Rabbi Jay will bring out. Zohar Amar is the one who has written about Argamon. He's written about a lot of Lechem Aponim. He's done a lot of interesting work. And the question is the water buffalo kosher? Well, we now know what we have to look for. The important thing is to look for a split hoof and Jewish cud, maybe tradition. Well, let's see. So what we decided to do is we were interested in the water buffalo. We wanted to serve water buffalo at one of the exotic kosher dinners that we made. We've made two of them in Yerushalayim, one in New York, one in L.A., and one in Chicago. At each of these dinners, we try to serve exotic food that you can't get commercially. We wanted to serve in Yerushalayim water buffalo. And as much as we can, we try to minimize any machlokas, any dissension. We try to get everybody on board. And so we wrote a letter to former Chief Rabbi Amar. And we asked him, we said, we want to know, could we get an official letter from the chief rabbinate that water buffalo is kosher? He said, well, send me the facts. I need to know split hoof, Jewish cud, Masorah, and we'll see what else he wanted to know in a minute. So we said, okay. We got some textbooks. We sent him information on the digestive system of the water buffalo. We sent him pictures of the hooves. And then we went out looking for Masorah. And we found this guy, Rabbi Yitzchak Wirtz. He lives in Yerushalayim, or he lived in Yerushalayim, and he had been a shoichet in the, we'll see in a minute, 1948, 49, he had been a shoichet. And we went to him, and we interviewed him. We're here with Rabbi Yitzchok Gwirtz.
In Yerushalayim.
He was born in Yerushalayim. In what year did you shechet? I was a shochet, he answered. He's no longer with a shochet at this point. In what year did you shechet? In the founding of the state of Israel, meaning 1948. We asked him who he learned Shechita from. He said Rav Rome, he was the chief Shochet at the time, chief Rabbi Herzog, and Rav Frank, who was the chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim. Did you Shech Jamus? Jamus is the Arabic word for buffalo, which is what a lot of Israelis use. In modern Hebrew, buffalo is called either buffalo or ta'oa. But ta'oa is also a biblical word, and buffalo is probably not the biblical ta'oa. So a lot of Israelis call it by the Arabic word, which is jamus. So we said to him, did you shecht jamus? We asked him what year. He said Tavshin Chet, 1948. Once or a lot? He said a lot. So we asked him, did he shecht a lot of jamusim? He said, for sure, 1,000. Now, names are not enough. In other words, what he's calling a jamus, maybe is not what we call jamus. We had pictures. Unfortunately, he was too old. We couldn't take him out to the field. But we showed him pictures of the water buffalo. He said, as he shechted, he talks like a Jew. You ask him what year. He says, Tavshin Chet. You know, it doesn't say 1948, but in 1948. And he shechted thousands. And we asked him from where. They would import them live from Turkey. And it was under the hashkacha of Rav Chi Pesach Frank and other acceptable hashkachas. So here we have a Masorah. We went to Rav Chief Rabbi Amar. We gave him the information. We told him about Rav Gvirtz. We also found Menaker, who lives in Petach Tikva, who had done Nikur on water buffalo. And we gave that information to Chief Rabbi Amar. And to his credit, he not only took our testimony, he went and he interviewed these guys on his own. So we'll get to his final word in a second. But just about this question of tradition about Masorah, we've seen that despite the Chazon Ish being a minority opinion, despite Rav Vozner's position on the bison, some people still want to be concerned about the need for Masorah, and so, when possible, we look for Masorah for the animals. So now we've seen there are clear signs in the Chumash. There's a question of Masorah. What other questions could there be? We wanted to get a letter from Rav Amar. We showed him, split hoof, chew its cud. There is a Masorah. What more could you want? Well, there's one more issue. That's the issue of dentition. Do we have any dentists here? Okay, so I might need your help here a little bit. But the teeth seems to be an important issue as far as Rav Amar is concerned. I suspect as a kid he had some cavities, the dentist didn't do a good job, and he now has a tooth, because you'll see, it's a big issue by him, the teeth. Why are teeth an issue as far as kosher animals? Well, there's a really long Gemara here, which we're not going to read, but it's a fascinating Gemara in Chulin Nun Tesamad Aleph, where the Gemara tells you that really all you need is split hoof and chew its cud. But what happens if I can't check if it has a split hoof or if it chews its cud? For example, what happens if the animal, you know, I'm out in the forest, I come across an animal that I don't recognize, and the bottom of all the hooves are cut off. I can't check the hooves to see if it has split hooves. So the Gemara tells you that what could you do? You could inspect the upper jaw. If there are no teeth in the front part of the upper jaw, then you know it's a kosher animal. As long as it's not a baby camel. Adult camels are not kosher. Adult camels have upper, not really teeth, the Gemara calls them nevim, which is sort of like teeth. Adult camels have them. Baby camels haven't yet grown them. The other non-kosher animals that chew their cud, sorry, that have split hooves but don't chew their cud, no, they chew their cud but don't have split hooves, the Anevet and the Shafan, all have upper teeth. So the Gemara says again, if you find an animal, you don't know if it's kosher, check the upper jaw, no upper front teeth, it's kosher as long as it's not a baby camel. How about if you can't check the jaw, but you can't check the hooves? No problem. The Gemara says, check the hooves. If it has split hooves, and you know it's not a pig, you know it's a kosher animal. How about if I can't check the jaw, and I can't check the hooves? No problem. Shech the animal, check the grain of the meat under the tail. If the grain of the meat runs warp and woof, and it's not an arod, I don't know exactly what an arod is, if it's not an arod, then you know it's kosher. So the one that is important as far as we're concerned right now is the teeth. The Gemara says like this. If you check, okay, you check the mouth, bodek bepiha, im en lashinayim lamala, if there are no teeth in the upper front part, we adu shehi tahara. Im lav, if not, meaning that there are upper front teeth, be adu shehi tmeya, you know it's not kosher. So this, hold on, well, this is the Gemara. The Shulchan, skip Rashi for a minute, the Shulchan Aruch quotes this almost verbatim. The Shulchan Aruch says, if you can't check, what do? Yivdok. You should inspect. Im ein la shinayim velo nivim lamala biyadua shehi tahora. If there are no upper front teeth, it's kosher. V'hu shiyakir ben gamala, and you know that it's not a baby camel. There is a very, very important difference, which you've already noticed there. What's the difference?
You don't know. You can't check.
What do you, if you can't? Right. I can't check the hooves, I check the teeth.
I check the hooves and they have teeth. What do you do with that?
Oh, meaning, or even say better. Say, not only did I check the hooves, I've watched the animal a long time. They chew their cud. I know the animal. I've watched him. He's in my garden. Okay. Rashi seems to be addressing that. Rashi says that, kol behemesh ein l'shinayim b'yadur shemal adgera v'ein anu tzuchim lahamtin ad shenira imalas gerahi. But if I waited and I found out that it chooses cud, what would you say from Rashi over here? Do I care about the teeth? The teeth would seem not to make a difference. However, what's important is what you noticed, I think, as soon as we're reading this, what does the Gemara seem to imply? The Gemara says, check the teeth. If there are no upper front teeth, kosher. If there are upper front teeth, the Gemara said, not good. What did the Shulchan Aruch say? If there are no upper front teeth, kosher. If there are upper front teeth, Shulchan Aruch didn't say a word about it. So here's where the problem comes up. Former Chief Rabbi Amar felt very strongly that teeth are a bidirectional sign. If there are no upper front teeth, it's kosher. If there are upper front teeth, it's not kosher. Even if I know it chooses cud, I know it has split hooves. If there are, most other poskim say no. It's a unidirectional sign when I don't know any other information. I check. If there are no upper front teeth, I could say it's kosher. But if I know the animal split hooves, I know it chews its cud, I don't care about the teeth. Okay, that's what most poskim say.
But then it can't have front teeth. If it has front teeth, it's not kosher. It can't.
Why? Why, if it has upper front teeth, it's not kosher? Where'd you see that in the Chumash? Where'd you see that anyplace?
Because you said if it doesn't have teeth, then it's kosher.
Right.
So if it has teeth, it can't be kosher.
No. There could be kosher with and without, but there's only kosher without. In other words, if it does not have teeth, it's kosher. There could be kosher that do and that don't.
It could be with teeth.
Right. That's how most poskim understand it. Chief Rabbi Amar said like you.
In the science world, do we see that?
Oh, so we'll get to that in 1 minute. Here we go. But... That's what it seems from the Gemara. That's what it would seem according to most authorities. Rav Amar disagrees with that. Yes?
But how could you read
you're saying, what does Rav Amar do with the fact that Torah says split? We'll get to, hopefully, I'll try to explain him in a minute. Let me see what he, first let me show you what he imposed on us because of his understanding. He said, yeah? I'm going to show you in a minute, pictures. Okay, so let me show you what he imposed on us, and then we'll get back to that, and also to that if I didn't answer it. Okay, Rav Amar said, you want a letter from me that the water buffalo is kosher. Split hooves, chew its cud, tradition, and I want to make sure there are no upper front teeth. We said, no problem, we just got to find you a water buffalo. But you guys know, we got to travel around Israel, you'll find everything there. Come to the Chula Valley. The Chula Valley has a nature reserve with water buffalo. So we took the chief rabbi on a little field trip. And we went up to the Chula Valley. And we said, let's go check out the water buffalo. And here you see him checking out the hooves of a dead water buffalo. The problem is, you know, he found a dead buffalo and he looked at the hooves. But then from a distance, he sees the buffalo there. And I don't know, do you treat patients like at a distance? It doesn't work. You know, Rav Amar said, so come here, buffalo. You know, and they didn't cooperate. So he said, if you want me to tell you if it's kosher or not, I need to know if it has upper front teeth. and these water buffalo out in the Chula Valley are not cooperating.
Did he look in the teeth of the dead
one? No, I guess there were no skulls. He didn't. He wanted to see. He wasn't satisfied. We said, no problem. There's a moshav near Ashkelon called Moshav Bitzaron, where they raise water buffalo for milk. Because the water buffalo milk, you make out of it real mozzarella cheese. If you want real mozzarella, you go to Italy, you get mozzarella di bufalo. That's the real mozzarella. And you can buy in Israel mozzarella cheese from water buffalo. You could buy chocolate milk. That's the only thing. Whenever we go there with these trips, my kids want me to bring back the chocolate milk from the water buffalo milk. We said to the chief rabbi, let's go on a field trip to Moshav Bitzaron. And here you have the water buffalo. We're out there with the chief rabbi. And here, no problem, the chief rabbi is looking into the mouth. This guy is the owner of the place. Actually, this guy's the owner. This guy's the owner. This guy's from the Misvana Chaklut. And he's trying to look in the teeth, and it's not working. This water buffalo is still not being cooperative. Okay, so I'm about to tell you. So here's what happened. The way it works in Israel is every local rabbinate could give hashgacha. Okay? They can give, they are authorized to say it's kosher. The chief rabbi of the country has veto power. So here's what happened. The chief rabbi is looking in the mouth. He wants to see the teeth. He's not seeing them. He says, oh, you guys have been selling this as kosher under local supervision. He said, until I could see those teeth, I'm freezing your supervision. I want a water buffalo head on my desk. Well, he froze the two. Like you're saying, it's been sold as kosher until then. He now froze that local supervision, and now the owners of the place were under pressure to get a water buffalo head on the desk of the chief rabbi. So here we go. So, yeah. What? Oh, excellent. There's a Gemara that says that only kosher milk is megabein, makes into cheese. What?
Butter.
Cheese. Anyhow, correct. That is usually not used as a sign. In other words, we usually look for split hoofs, Shuritz cut. That's not brought, for example, in the Shulchan Aruch as a definitive sign of a way to identify a kosher animal. It's sort of like a sniff, like an additional sign. And indeed, Zohar Amar has recently studied the milk of giraffe and of human milk. It sort of falls in between the kosher and the non-kosher. But it's correct. It should be a sign, but it's not. For some reason, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't bring that as a way. There are other signs in the Gemara as well. The Gemara says that a kosher and non-kosher animal can hybridize. But the Shulchan Aruch doesn't mention that as a kosher sign either. Okay, so here we have now the chief rabbi. He has the water buffalo head on his desk. This buffalo now was very cooperative. You see the mouth is opening, and now we could see that in the back, there are molars and premolars in the bottom jaw and in the upper jaw. In the front, we have these canines, and I think there's an incisor there as well. On the bottom, on the top, there's nothing. There's just a pad. Okay, the top, absolutely no teeth, just a pad. And when you've seen cows in the pasture, when they're chewing their cud, you could see they're sort of grinding their teeth, the bottom teeth, against this pad on the top. And that's why, when you take the kids to a petting farm, in Israel we have these peanut chai all over the place. Take them and you see a goat or you see a cow, you could stick your hand in the mouth and you could feel that pad on the top and they can't bite you. They just have these bottom teeth that grind against the pad. So now the chief rabbi is very happy. Here we have a water buffalo that finally was willing to open his mouth, but he's clever. We can't put one by our chief rabbi. He said, wait a minute. How do I know this isn't a juvenile and there are teeth that are yet going to come out? Now, you look at that head and you tell me, is that a juvenile? But okay, so what's the only way to know if there are teeth that are going to come down? We got x-ray. Thank goodness that I work with Ari Greenspan. This guy over here, Ari Greenspan, he's a dentist. So we took the water buffalo head to his office. And here is the x-ray of the teeth. There's the bottom. I don't really know what we're looking at. There's no indication of upper teeth. That I can tell you. In the bottom, he says there's decay in the lower right anterior. I don't know what that means. But that's what happens when you work with a dentist. So, but finally, you can see that there's absolutely no indication of teeth that are going to be coming in over here. So we got our letter from the chief rabbi, water buffalo is kosher. So if this is what we had to go through for water buffalo. And let me tell you why it's so strange. Because now, remember, why do we want to know if it's kosher, if it's a behemoth or a chaya? We wanted to know about chelev, and we wanted to know about kisir adam, covering the blood. Well, all of that I showed you was in section 79, section 80 in Yoredeya. If you go back to the section that talks about the mitzvah of Kisur Adam in Siman 29, there the Shulchan Aruch, where did the Shulchan Aruch live, the guy who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, Yosef Karo? He came from Spain, but where did he live when he wrote it? Tzvat. Where did I say we went to look at the water buffalo? Moshe, in the Chula Valley. The Chula Valley and Tzvat are quite near each other. There's probably a high probability that Rav Yosef Karo had indeed seen water buffalo. And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Chaf Tet, we're talking about Kisur Adam, he says, Habuffalo, Bet Vav Pei Lam, Habuffalo Min Behemah. He tells you that the buffalo is a behemah. On that, the Ramah, who lives where? In Krakow, and probably never saw a water buffalo, doesn't know exactly what the Shulchan Aruch is talking about, says that we have a suffix, and therefore we treat it like a behemah and a chaya. Now, the Shulchan Aruch, just to be clear, most of the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, he didn't make up. He got them from earlier sources. Where is he getting the halacha about the buffalo? Not from France, but he's quoting Rabbi Shaya Mitraini. Rabbi Shaya Mitraini was a 13th century Italian posuk from Treni, Italy. What's buffalo in Italian? Well, we call it today the water buffalo, where they make the mozzarella, the buffalo from. So Rabbi Shaya Mitraini in the 13th century was already writing about the buffalo. And Rabbi Yosef Karo in the early 15th century, living in Swat, is writing about a buffalo as if he knows what it is. It seems very clear that water buffalo has been treated as kosher, you know, throughout the generations. So it was pretty amazing that Rav Amar had us go through all these hoops, but eventually, thanks to, you know, to this cooperative water buffalo over here, we got the letter from Rav Amar that water buffalo is indeed a kosher animal. I don't know. 7 years ago, 8 years ago, it all blends. I don't know. Okay, here are a few other examples, and then we'll get to somebody's question here about, you know, nature. Here's a sheep skull. A sheep skull, you could see again, you see back here all of these molars and premolars. We come to the front. On the bottom, you have teeth. The top, no teeth. And the jaw is quite thin over there. There's no room for a teeth. There are clearly no teeth that were coming over here. This is just where they had that pad that he grinded against. On the other hand, this is a sheep. There's one exception, and this is why Rav Amar is really, really into the teeth issue, is because there's an animal called the red deer. The red deer, it's called in North America the elk. They're the same species. Today the scientists actually, because of genetic reasons, are calling them different species, but they look identical. The red deer and the elk, in Europe it's called the red deer, in the US it's called elk. In Israel it's called the Ayal Australi, because those that were imported to Israel, they brought from Australia. They're not native to Australia, they don't come from Australia, but if you look at all of Rav Amar's literature, it's the Ayal Australi. The red deer is a deer. It chews its cud, it has split hooves, it looks like a deer, it smells like a deer, it walks like a deer, but fortunately for him, he has, if you take a look, there's one tooth on each side. Now, it's an unusual tooth. It's behind this, what do you call this? The suture, what's it called? The break in the bones in the skull, what do you call those? The suture, it's behind the suture, it points forward, it doesn't look like it's very useful as a tooth. According to the animal, I don't know who studies these things, but they tell you that there's not really a tooth. It's actually millions and millions of years ago, if you went back, you would have seen that this is the beginning of a tusk that came out. And if you come back in a few million years, they insist that this thing will be gone. And then, of course, when I continue to email this expert in red deer, he couldn't understand why the rabbis didn't really care about that in a few million years it's not going to have that tooth. So it has this tooth on each side, one tooth on each side. Because of that, Rav Amar has come out with numerous articles explaining why the red deer is not kosher. Everybody else on both sides of the Atlantic insists that the red deer is kosher. Rav Machpud, who gives a well-known hashkach in Israel, has shechted these red deer. We served it at the dinner that we did in Los Angeles. We came to the OU. We said, here are the facts. We're not trying to pull anything over on you. Here's the red deer. Here's the tooth. Here's Rav Amar's article. Hold on. And the OU said, we're not beholden to Rav Amar. We will paskin on our own. And they investigated the issue, and they decided that there's no question that the elk is kosher. Yeah?
Just don't call it a tooth. Then you have no problem.
If anybody's really interested, there's an article in Hamayan, which gives the other side. Rav Amar has written in a whole bunch of journals. There's an article in Hamayan, which gives the other side, and addresses this from two points. One is the tooth sign unilateral or bidirectional? In other words, is it, if there's a tooth, it doesn't matter or not? Or is the tooth sign is not kosher? And even if you hold that it's bidirectional, are these the teeth that the Gemara is talking about? is this a tooth? Because it's clearly a non-functional tooth. The way it's sticking out, it's not going to meet up any tooth on the bottom. So both of those points were addressed in that article. But nonetheless, Chief Rabbi Amar was the chief rabbi until a few months ago, and therefore Red Deer was not allowed to be served commercially in Israel as kosher. And now we have a new chief rabbi who's from the same school as Rav Amar, and I suspect that it's going to stay that way right now. So if you want Red Deer, you got to do it in the U.S. or Canada.
And which
in Israel? In Israel, so I haven't discussed it with anybody except Rav Machpud. Rav Machpud has a well-respected badatz. He's Tamani, but Ashkenazim, and it's well-respected by everybody. And what happened was two different people imported Red Deer about 15 years ago from Australia. They wanted to raise it commercially to sell. And now they have these Red Deer, and suddenly everybody pulled the carpet out from under them. The Misrad HaKlaut decided that it's a protected species and they can't slaughter it. And the chief rabbi decided that it's not kosher, so you can't sell it as kosher. So the rug was pulled out from under them. They've lost a lot of money. They recently sued the government. And us Israeli taxpayers are now paying for the screw-up of the Misrad HaKlaut to the tune of about $1 million. So because the farmers won the lawsuit. But in any event, what happened was they have these red deer now. And they're breeding and producing. And what are they going to do with them? So they sell a lot of them to Arabs who shech them. But everyone's all about Machpud shechs them, and as far as he's concerned, they're kosher.
And in the U.S.,
he said? In the U.S., the OU, Rav Belsky, Paskin, they're the kosher. So, and I'm sure that you can get, you know, the OU has, I'm sure they have an internal document explaining their position. The OU has all of these internal documents where they explain. Okay, so that was the Red Deer. We'll skip that. Close. We don't. Rav Amar, it was a Sephardi chief rabbi. We didn't choose to go to him. We had an incompetent Ashkenazi chief rabbi. No. I'm not saying that as personal. The Ashkenazi chief rabbi wasn't qualified, not for the Beis Din, so he couldn't be our Beis Din, and not in Kashrus. So they split the jobs. But for the last 10 years, Rav Amar held the Beis Din portfolio and the Kashrus portfolio because Rav Metzger wasn't qualified. So we didn't go to, we went to the chief rabbi who is in charge of kashrus. I'm not saying he's not qualified. I'm saying in this regard he wasn't qualified. That's all I was saying is that he wasn't qualified. So for the kashrus portfolio, Rav Amar was the one who had it. We didn't go to any badatzes for that. We go to Rav Machpud because he has a well-respected badatz and because he's willing to talk. Rav Rubin, we're going to get to the giraffe dissection in a minute. The first giraffe dissection we did in about 2004, we invited Rabbi Rubin to come and participate in the dissection. And you would think that just out of curiosity, nothing to do with kashrus, it was a novella. You would think that somebody would be interested in the mitzvos, and he wasn't interested in coming. But that Rav Rubin right now is a lot of hot water with what's going on. I don't know if you're following what's going on in Zoglobek in the last 2 weeks. There was a somebody snuck into Ofer Schlachthaus and took videos that looked really bad. And the new chief rabbi came out, Rav Lau, that he was going to inspect it and take away the hashkacha. And anyhow, it's under Rav Rubin. So he's been right now hiding. So I couldn't go find him. It's a big... many of them are not willing to talk about anything. They're not approachable. They're not... Yeah. So what does Rav Amar do with that? Yes. Excellent question. What he will answer, and there is an answer, by the way, I should change it. He's not a total Das Yochid. He has a very important previous posting behind him. The previous Sfari Chief Rabbi of Yerushalayim was Mashash. And Rav Mashash asked it as well. Not specifically the Red Deer, but he viewed the teeth the same way that Rav Amar did. So he's not all on his own over here. And what he will explain to you is that when the Torah says malegera, what does it mean to chew your cud? What does it mean malegera? Well, it's a very strange sign. Think of it, every other sign of the Torah: fish, fins and scales; animals, we have split hoof; chagavim, you have wings that cover over the body; and four wings, jumping legs. They're all physical signs. Malegera would sound like a behavioral, which is the only example of that, atypical. And therefore, he would say that by malegera, it means not having the upper front teeth. And he's basing that sort of on Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon tries to also explain malegera as being a physical sign. So, but that's what he'll say. He'll say that We don't know exactly what Malagir is. Look, go back. Why would you need a Masorah? Where did the whole idea of Masorah come from? There seems to be very clear simonim, split over and chew its cud. And what they'll tell you is, we don't know exactly what it means and how to understand the sign. So we think that Malagir is pretty straightforward, but I can prove to you that it's really not straightforward. How can I prove it to you? What's an Anevet and a Shafan? Well, what we call an Eved Shafan today don't seem to fit our definition of Malagera. And yet the Torah says they're Malagera. So maybe Malagera isn't as simple as what we think it is. Yeah, so we call it a Hyrex or a Kuni. Correct. But they're not Malagera in the sense that we understand Malagera. So it's not. So that's how he'll explain it. Okay, Yak. Yak is just comes up all the time. Yak questions, because in Israel it seems to be almost now standard that after you finish your army, you have to go out to somewhere in Asia. And I get questions at least once every 6 months. I'm going off to some place where I don't know where it is, Thailand or Tibet. And I want to know, can I drink yak milk? Because for the milk to be kosher, the animal has to be kosher. Yak has split hooves. Yak chews its cud. Yak, as far as I can tell, we cannot find any Masorah on it. I don't know any tradition on it. And yak does not have the upper front teeth. So yak would seem to be kosher. Barbarossa is a very important one. Those of you who remember, about 30 years ago, there was a New York Times article that talked about the kosher pig. Someone discovered these kosher pigs in Southeast Asia, the Barbarossa, and this, you know, was a big splash in the New York Times. I don't know why anybody thought it was a kosher pig. Barbarossa is a pig. It's not a kosher pig. Its digestive system is just like that of every other pig, and I could prove to you it's not kosher. Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Tendler have both come out that it's not kosher. So if they agree on it, we have no credit. No, but it's a pig. It's a pig like every other pig. I don't know why anybody would have thought to suggest that it was kosher. Okay, so we've... What? I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. But it doesn't chew its cud by any definition. I mean, it doesn't... That must have been a Masorah from somewhere. It's not the other ones. The fact that split hoof, even if you don't chew the, check the mouth, you know, as long as it's not a pig, that's based on the Chumash. The grain of the meat must have been some sort of Masorah that Chazal had. I don't know where they got it.
Like,
No. Nobody's asked for that. Nobody has. I don't know. We're going to show you in a minute. I'm going to show you giraffe dissection. In the giraffe, we did look to see the grain of the meat, and indeed it runs warp and woof in the giraffe. We'll get to the giraffe in a minute, because we've talked about the signs of the Torah. We've talked about Masorah. We've talked about dentition. The only thing we have to talk about now is hooves and giraffe issues. Okay, because there are numerous misconceptions surrounding kashrus of giraffe. Here is in the plains of Kenya. Here is in the wilds of Ramat Gan. These are pictures that I took. And... Where's the one in the back? Do you have a picture of that one? Oh, okay. Okay, first misconception. I saw that the shul, we daven here, the Shabbos, it's questionable whether one could daven here because you don't have a lot of those parsha sheets to read. In Israel, when you walk into any shul, there are piles and piles of parsha sheets. You could start reading them and they'll finish davening and you won't even be finished yet. So there are piles of these sheets, and one of them put out by an organization called Mibrei Sheet, a few years ago, this is from Tufshin Samach Dalad, 2004, for some reason had a discussion on giraffe. I know why. It was Pashas Truma and it had to do with the Tochash. They had a definition of a discussion of giraffe and said, the giraffe, kol simanei tzara, giraffe have all the signs of being kosher. Ulechora mutar lochlo, it would seem it's permitted to eat. Ach, hu ne'asar l'achila, it's prohibited. Why? Kevin shet savaro aroch ma'od ve'nenu yodim keitzad ve'hechon l'shchot oto. We don't know how or where to shecht it. So this seems to be a very widespread belief. Many, many people seem to be of the belief that we don't know where to shecht the giraffe. Anybody here not know where to shecht the giraffe? Okay, good. But let me ask you, don't know where to shecht the giraffe, but let me ask you, do you know where to shecht the cow? No, so that's okay. So here's the story. I never understood this. It seems that wherever I go, people tell me about this, that we don't know where to shecht the giraffe. So it seems quite strange because the Shulchan Aruch has an entire section. Makom hashchita betzavar, where on the neck you shecht. And it doesn't give you a specific location. It doesn't say, you know, by the X we shecht. It gives you an upper landmark and a lower landmark, and everything in between is kosher for shchita, which means that for a pigeon, you have a few inches. For a cow, next time you see a cow, look at the neck. It's a pretty darn big neck that the cow has. The cow you have over a foot. So a giraffe you have over 6 feet. You can't miss. But, you know, for a long time, I was still confused because I knew this halacha. But everywhere I go, people tell me we don't know where to shech giraffe. So finally, this is a few years back, I called up the guy who was in charge of fleishik for the OU. And he said, tell me, am I crazy or is it, you know, why does nobody else seem to know where to shech giraffe? And he said, anyone who does not know where to shech the giraffe either knows nothing about the laws of shechita or cannot hit the side of a barn with a baseball. You can't miss. It's, you have the whole neck. Okay, so that's the first misconception about giraffe. Let's move on. This was another one. This is an American parsha thing. Halacha Brura. I cut off who publishes it and who wrote it because I don't want to embarrass them too much. Okay, it says over here, some poskim, I don't know who, question whether giraffe's hooves are actually split. A camel is listed in the Torah among the animals that do not have a split hoof. Although a camel's toes are split, their underpart is covered by a thick pad of spongy tissue which absorbs the pressure when it walks and also waters the surface. Okay. The Torah does not consider a camel's toe to be fully split. A giraffe has a thin pad underneath its toes. The question is whether a thin pad is significant enough to prevent the hoof from being considered fully split. Ignore these references because we'll see in a minute. Okay, so he says here, two important things. He says camels have split hooves, but they have some pad, so it's not considered fully split. And a giraffe also has a thin pad. Does that prevent it from being called a split hoof? Let's look at some hoofs. Here's a llama. Here's the llama's hoof. It looks actually nice and split. When we ask the llama to pick up his foot, we see that the whole posterior half is all fused. Front is split. That's why when he's standing, it looks split. But in the back, it's all together, not a split hoof. The camel. The Torah tells us it's not split. Here's my hoof, not split at all. Here's the camel's hoof, looks split. But when he picks up his foot, we take a look, and you see the whole back is not split at all. Nothing to do with a pad. It's actually a almost like, not quite a paw, but it's a different design foot. The whole back, nothing split over there. And a matter of fact, if you look up Rashi, we're not going to read it now because it's getting late. Rashi in Vayikra Yud Aleph Chavav, Rashi describes this picture perfectly. I don't know if Rashi in France ever saw a camel or if he's basing it on tradition, but he describes perfectly what you see in that picture. A pig, the Torah tells us, has a split hoof, and indeed, fully split. A red deer, well, we know it has those teeth, but how about its hoof? And you can see it's a fully split hoof. So the question is, how about the giraffe? And the giraffe hoof, indeed, is fully split. There's no question about it. There's no thin pad. There's no thick pad. There are no pads on the giraffe hoof. It's just simply a normal split hoof, like every other animal that has a split hoof. And those of you who want, your son and daughter-in-law saw it. We have in our house a giraffe foot, and you can come and you can see the giraffe hoof. It's fully split. So you wonder where we got the giraffe hoof? We'll get to that in a minute. Okay, here is another guy who has a long piece about this business, about the giraffe and being split. Let's see if this works.
Just a question regarding the laws of Shechita and Kashrut. Somebody recently was talking about the Kashrut of a giraffe. And I thought it'd be a good opportunity to discuss it.
Okay, you know what? It's late. Let me skip this guy. He talks like 10 minutes on this. He again mentions his business about the pad. And then he mentions also something else. Where is it here? About de-skinning it. I'm not sure exactly why he needs to de-skin it. Maybe it's only in the audio. Anyhow, he talks about having to de-skin the animal. I'm not sure why that's relevant to the kashrut, but if he questioned it, here we go, hold on. Here you go, and additionally, its skin is very thick and heavy, thus making the skinning process very difficult and costly. I don't know, we decided to give it a try, and here's the giraffe with half his skin off, and here he's fully de-skinned. I don't know why it should be a problem. Now, what happened was, about 10 years ago, in the Ramat Gan Safari, this giraffe, this is a female, miscarried, a full-term fetus. The safari contacted us. They wanted to know, do we want to do a post-mortem on that fetus? I can't turn down such an offer. I'm sure if you were to do a post-mortem on a giraffe fetus, you would run to it. We didn't run. We first assembled a team. We got together a bunch of people. And then we went to the Ramat Gan Safari. We did a post-mortem. And we were looking for things related to the kashrus. For example, none of you questioned me when I said definitively that the Shulchan Aruch gives us landmarks, the top and the bottom, and everything in between is kosher. Well, how do you know that the giraffe neck has the same structure? Maybe those landmarks don't exist on the giraffe neck. So we wanted to inspect the giraffe neck, and internally as well, the trachea and the esophagus, to see if the structure indeed the same as in a cow. How about the digestive system? How does it look compared to a cow? How about the chalev? Rav Machpud is an expert in chalev, in Nikor. We invited him to come. Is the chalev the same? So we went and we did this dissection on the giraffe fetus. It was very interesting. We found more or less what we needed. But then a year later, I remember exactly when it was. It was Chol HaMoed Pesach. The safari called again. They said, the mother has died. Are you interested in doing a postmortem on the mother? We said, for sure. Might as well do it on a full-grown animal as well. This was Chol HaMoed Pesach. We said, we'll be there after Pesach. They said, no, you don't understand. The fetus we're able to put in the freezer for you. This is the mother. It's 19 feet. This is not going into the freezer. Either you come tomorrow or it's going to the lions. So we went on Chol HaMoed Pesach, and that's what you see over here. This is the dissection of the giraffe. And this is our motley crew that came to do it. And, we have even a nice video you can see a little bit. Okay, this is the dentist, Greenspan. He likes to do surgery.
Just
got to
flip it straight up.
Okay. You can see it's Chol HaMoed. We're all wearing our white shirts. It was, Okay, you get the point. Yes. Okay, we'll skip this. Okay, now, what's very important, and this is what drives me crazy about that parachute sheet, thin pads, thick pads, you don't have to do a dissection to see if the giraffe has a pad under its foot. You need to simply clarify. Halacha, like, I guess, physics, you know, you need your theoreticians and you need your experimentalists. It's very important that there be people who sit in the Beis Medrash and never leave the Beis Medrash and learn, you know, day and night. But those are not the people who should be passing the shaylas. A person who passes the shayla needs to also know the mitzias. You need to know the reality. If you want to pass a medical question, you need to understand the medical facts. If you want to pass a question about a giraffe kashrus, you need to know at least what the hooves look like. So, and you know, I always like to bring this Gemara from Sanhedrin. The Gemara says that Rav said that he spent 18 months living with the shepherds to understand the mum in an animal. Now, the Gemara actually later criticizes him. Maybe he was too much, maybe he was too big an expert. But the point is, Rav wasn't known as a botlan. Rav was somebody who was, you know, one of the most important amoras. And yet Rav understood, if you want to paskin about a bechor, if a bechor has a mum kavua or a mum over, you have to know the reality. You have to know the mitzvot. And he went out and he lived with the shepherds for 18 months. The least you could do if you're going to write an article about the kashrus of a giraffe is go to the zoo and look if it has a split hoof or not. I mean, the guy could write an article about, a giraffe having pads, and therefore it's a question if it's kosher. It's just crazy. However, because I see that he didn't want to go out and check it out, we now have provided the information. We wrote about the giraffe dissections in Hebrew in Tchumen, and in English in Torah Mada Journal. Anybody who's interested, you can get the articles. I'll send them to Rabbi Kellerman. And so now you don't have to leave the Beis Medrash. You could paskin on giraffe without leaving the Beis Medrash. Yes? Okay, I skipped that because it was getting late. Here you go. Rav Sad Yigon says that the Zomer, in that list that I gave at the very beginning from Parshas Re'eh, the last of them is the Zomer, and Rav Sad Yigon translates it as Giraffa. Indeed, he translates it as such. The problem is that's not a Mesorah. A Mesorah needs to be generation to generation, a living Mesorah. Now, how do I know what he calls a Zomer, a Giraffa, is what we're calling a Giraffa. How do I... yes, Rav Sad Yigon translates Zomer as Giraffe. There are those who say that the Zomer is a giraffe. No. And the Living Torah, Rav Aryeh Kaplan says also, but that, in other words, that wouldn't help us if we want to determine if it's kosher. You need to a Mesorah has to be one generation to the next. It has to be from your mother or your teacher. Or, you know, it's not enough that it's in writing. Because, again, how do I know his giraffe in Arabic is what we call today a giraffe? But yes, indeed... he does. But what I point out is the fact that Sadiq mentions it is not a Mesorah, and such a claim would never hold up by something that you really need a Mesorah for, like by birds. Okay.
Is giraffe a
Messiah or a
maybe? We don't have a Messiah. We have to treat it as both. And again, it doesn't have antlers. It has horns.
You said one of the guys went to look at the fat.
We just wanted to see if it had the same structure. We wanted to see. And it turns out that a giraffe is really structurally very, very similar to a cow with just a really stretched out neck. For example, the neck, the structure of the kana and veshet, of the trachea and the esophagus, the structure is identical to that of a cow. The stomachs, the four stomachs are structurally identical to that of a cow. The only thing that was fascinating is that there was no gallbladder. So we thought either we had a diseased giraffe, or we made a fantastic discovery. Until we looked in the literature, and you know, the veterinarians knew about this. Giraffes don't have gallbladders. That doesn't have any ramifications halakhically. So here's just, you know, part of the dissection. We'll just skip all the... Here's the lungs. We knew, but I don't remember. It might be in the article. Anyway, but the only thing that, of course, nobody has mentioned, that nobody asked, I've talked about the giraffe, and I showed you that it has split hooves, and it chews its cud. What do we need to know? Here you go. We did a CT on the giraffe. Not just, but it's really unclear. On my hair, it looks much clearer. You could come look at it. We did a CT of the skull. Oh, now you can't see anything.
We did a CT of the skull, and indeed, there are no upper...
Well, there were no upper front teeth in the skull, and there were no upper front teeth that were going to be coming down. So the giraffe, we do not have a Mesorah. Rav Sadia Gaon is not sufficient. It does have split hooves. It does chew its cud. Does not have upper front teeth, and it has all of the signs. So why don't we eat giraffe? Why don't you have giraffe in your kosher butcher shop? It's expensive. It's difficult. It's why is it expensive? It's expensive to buy one, and more than expensive to buy one, it's expensive to process. Because in order to shecht it, you have to restrain it. You can't anesthetize it. And in order to restrain it, it's not a trivial matter. Giraffe have no natural enemies. Giraffe are very, very strong. A giraffe could kill an adult lion with one kick. An adult giraffe could kill an adult lion with one kick. So I was at one point, we were looking to buy one. We actually had the OU working with us. They found the guy in the U.S. who was selling a giraffe. They called him, and the deal was almost done. We almost had a giraffe until the guy said, you know, before I sell it, I just want to come and inspect your facilities where you're going to be keeping it. Obviously, he was under a misunderstanding of what we were planning to do with it. So when he understood, the sale fell through. But in the meantime, while the OU was negotiating the purchase, I was looking into restraint systems. The zoo in Cheyenne, Wyoming seems to be experts in giraffe restraint systems. So I called up the zoo there in Cheyenne. I'm talking to them. And the guy said, you have to understand, these are strong animals. It could send you to the next county. And then I realized in Wyoming, counties aren't like in New York. I mean, there are... So the expense is not only the purchasing, but the whole process would be we'd need some sort of restraint system. You'd have to really make sure that on the one hand you're holding him, on the other hand, he's still alive. Giraffe are very fragile animals. When they ship them from zoo to zoo, about half of them die in transport. They're very sensitive animals, and so it's not a simple process. Now, we have, we think, found an expert in restraint without mechanical restraint, a guy in Namibia, where we recently shechted some Gemsbach, and he insists that he could restrain giraffe for us. And he does it with a technique called lots of locals. That's how we did the Gemsbach, and he claims he could do a giraffe. So if there's any donor who wants to buy one in Namibia, we're looking for a giraffe donation. Okay, then. So in conclusion, Mesorah is good to have, but not required according to most poskim. Teeth, the absence is the positive. Presence seems to be irrelevant, except for Rav Amar. Facts regarding hooves and other issues need to be clarified. You can't just go on hearsay. Giraffe, bison, yak, red deer, and water buffalo, I think are all kosher. You know, unlike swordfish, which I refuse to tell you my opinion, these seem to me that they're all kosher. So that's in terms of the giraffe. Okay, now, if you have more time, we can do exotic birds. So there was a restaurant in Kenya called the Carnivore, and Kishmoy Kenhu, they sold everything. But when I called them, they said, this is a few years ago, it's now illegal, most of these wild animals. They did sell giraffe and baboon and chimpanzee, they had everything. But they said, first thing we have to tell you is, they said, you know what the most popular dish is? Chicken. They said, everybody wants a little taste of a chimpanzee, and then give me some chicken for dinner. So they did sell giraffe. They said the meat is very tough. It's a very strong, muscular animal. In order to hold that neck up, you need very strong muscles in the neck. To keep that body up, you need... It's very muscular. It's very tough. They said, if you're going to shecht one, shecht the juvenile, you know, a very young one, which is what we're looking for anyhow, because we want to minimize the possibility of it being a treifa. But no, nobody eats it on a regular basis. I mean, every once in a while, goyim will kill it for, you know, for hunting purposes or whatever, but it's not, as far as I know, there's no culture in which a giraffe is a popular dish. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. You're saying if somebody in Morocco had a tradition, in Poland we should be able to use it, and if there wasn't in Poland, the Moroccans should be able to use it. Yes, did I say different tonight? I didn't say, did I?
No.
No, no. It would seem to be, that would seem to be the case. I don't know if we can keep going and do birds today. In birds, you need traditions, and in birds, there's indeed a discussion about that. And many people... Well, many people say both ways. There are some people who say, no, you need a local tradition. Others say you could rely on anybody's tradition. No, so there is no tradition. It's not that, you know, we wouldn't rely on the North American Jewish tradition, but the tradition of the American Indians doesn't help us. They could, but there's no bison anywhere else. Bison exists only in North America. It's a North American animal. No, it's quite different. Bison is very similar to cow, actually. They're the same genus, different species, but same genus. One is a boss, another is boss bison. But the bison and the buffalo are actually not closely related. Bison and cow could crossbreed. You remember the beefalo, that was the big thing a few years ago? The buffalo and the bison can't crossbreed even. They're not closely related. Okay, any other questions? Rabbi Jay? Are we going on to birds, or should we... Yes. 7 minutes? Okay. Okay, quickly, and then I'll tell you about the birds, but we got to do birds very quickly. Birds. How do we know which birds are kosher? Okay, guys, you did pretty good for animals. Tell me about birds. How do I know which birds are kosher? No, they gassed this guy here. He was good with the animals. Yeah? Okay, now we'll go with the guy behind you. Yeah? Oh, excellent. But that's not for the Torah. That's in the Gemara. I want to start first with the Torah, okay? How in the Torah do we know which birds are kosher? There's a list. The Torah gives us only a list. And what do they give a list of? The non-kosher. Okay, could someone do me a favor? I checked today. You have Art Scroll of Chumashim back here. Could someone get an Art Scroll of Chumash, please? Oh, this guy knows, but hold on. Let me do my show here, you know? Okay, this guy. Okay. If you can open up an Art Scroll Chumash, and right there, I see a lot of Art Scroll Chumash. Yeah, bring it up here. Okay, so the Torah gives us a list of the non-kosher birds, and what does that mean? Anything that's not in the list is kosher, right? So all I got to know is what's in the list. If it's not in the list, it's kosher. Here we go. Okay, somebody here, I can't see this on my glasses. If you could read for us in the English a few of those birds. Which is not kosher here?
One second. The article doesn't give you the...
Just read what article says. Read verse 13, 14, 15.
Verse 13, hold on. That's what passed.
There you go. Right here.
13, it says... birds that may not be eaten. Birds that may not be eaten. Abomination. But they give Hebrew. Nesher.
Read the English side, please.
This is the English side.
Nice. Okay.
They don't want to get into it.
Like you said, the art school doesn't translate. It just transliterates. Why?
Because they say somewhere here because they don't really know.
Okay, we don't know. Now, art school isn't the first to wimp out here. Do you have the original Hirsch Chumash in German here?
No,
come on. What? No, I don't want the English. The Hirsch in German. But the Hirsch in German, when Rav Hirsch translated the Chumash into German, Rav Hirsch transliterated the birds. He did the same thing Art School did. He also didn't translate. What? Yes, Living Torah does. He doesn't wimp out. But he gives you the options. He tells you that there are multiple possibilities for each. Okay, So why did they not translate? Because again, what's kosher? The Torah doesn't tell us which birds are kosher. There's no signs. Unlike what the Gemara gives us. Like she mentioned a minute ago, there are signs with the eggs. There are other signs. The Chumash does not give us signs. Gives you a list of 24 non-kosher. I know you're going to count and tell me 21. The Gemara says there are 24 here. The 24 non-kosher birds. Everything else is kosher. But in order to know which are kosher and which not, I need to know the 24 non-kosher. We don't know them. Oh, here you go. Here's the stone chumash. Look, we didn't need to get it. No. No, because it's not going to help us. But he translated. They'll tell you the osprey and the... Okay. Right. But the Hertz is willing to translate. Hirsch didn't translate. Yes. Hertz, okay. What? Ah, so wait. So the Mishnah, though, by the time of the Mishnah, by the time of the Mishnah, there was already a problem identifying the 24. So the Mishnah now gives us signs. We have to move along here. The Mishnah tells you that there are signs for non-kosher birds. Kol of hadores tamei. Any bird, exactly like you said, that's a predator is not kosher. And then there's one sign for non-kosher. What's the non-kosher? Predator. Then there are three signs for kosher. The kol sheish lo etzpiyatera. It has an extra toe. The zefek. It has a crop. The kork of a niklaf. Its gizzard is peelable. It's a sign that it's Torah, that it's kosher. So the Mishnah gives us four signs. One negative. If it's a predator, it's not kosher. Three positive. If it has an extra toe, if it has a crop, and if its gizzard has an inner peelable lining, it's kosher. That would seem to be great. We seem to have signs that tell us what's kosher. However, it's not so simple. Oh, look at what happened to those other pictures. Hold on, I had other pictures here. Oh, look at that. Well, it's not there. I took it out because I knew we were going to run out of time. Okay, a crop is the first stage of the digestive system. It's a little like sack. The bird comes down, eats some of the food, and needs to then go hide in the corner. It stores the food in this little sack called a crop, called the zephyr, and then the food goes down to the next stage. The last stage of the digestive system is the korkovan. In yeshiva, it's called the pipik. They always put that in the soup because it used to be the cheap part. And if the korkovan, if the gizzard, the pipik, has an inner peelable lining, that's a sign that it's a kosher bird. Now, the problem is that all of these things are not clear-cut. What's an extra toe? I don't know. A matter of fact, it's a machlokas, Rashi, and the Ran. Does it mean that the front toe is extra long? You've all seen chicken toes, right? Chicken feet. Extra long front toe. Or does it mean it has an extra toe in the back? And that's the easy one. What does it mean, a doris? What does it mean, a predator? So there are at least four different opinions what it means, a predator. Does it mean that it eats its prey when it's alive? Does it mean that it scoops its prey in the air? Does it mean that it holds it down? Does it mean that it injects some sort of poison into it, like the Ramban says? There are at least four different definitions of what a doris is. And worse, even if I know what an espiatera is, what a doris is, what a cork of a nikolaf means, do I need all of the signs? Is one of the signs enough? The Rambam says that one sign is more important than the others. He says cork of a nikolaf is more important than the other signs. Other people say, if you have the three positive signs, that tells you that it's not a doris. So we have a big problem. The Mishnah gives us these signs. How do we use them? We don't know. So far, the Chumash gave us a list. We don't know what the birds in the list are. The Mishnah gave us signs. We don't know how to use the signs. So what do we do? Well, Rashi over here, because of a problem that took place in the time of the Gemara, Rashi over here tells us the rule that we have today. The ein of nechal lano ele bimsoret of shemasru lano avoteinu betahor v'shalom masru lano yesh lechush. Rashi says, very simple. How do we know which birds are kosher? One simple rule, tradition. If it's a tradition from our forefathers that they ate it, it's kosher. If we don't have a tradition, we have to be concerned that maybe it's a predator and it's not kosher. So a very simple rule Rashi gives us in the 12th century, 11th century, and that's it. From the time of Rashi, that's been the rule. And it's very important to point out, here's the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch tells us all these rules about all the different signs, and then at the very end, the Shulchan Aruch says, the afal pish yesh lo gimel simanim elu ein lachlo lefish ein lefish anu choshesh shem hu doris el imkain yesh lahem mesorot shemot lehem avaseim shutar. So this is the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, who is the final authority for the Sfaradim, says you need a tradition. Many people think Sfaradim still rely on the signs. No, the Shulchan Aruch says you need tradition. Then the Shulchan Aruch gives the Sfaradim one little out. He says, Yesh omrim, shekol of, shechartimo rachav, kafraglo rachvo, it has a wide beak and webbed feet, like in a vase, like a goose, biadua she'en odoris. It's obviously not a predator. God just didn't build him to be a predator. With you, if you have webbed feet and a wide beak, you're not going to be a successful predator. So therefore, the Shulchan Aruch says, if I know it's not a predator, how do I know? Because it has a wide beak and webbed feet. Then, im yesh lo shlosha simonim begufo, it's kosher. And on that, the Ramah, the Ashkenazi posuk says, v'yoshom she'en lismoch afilo ozeh, he says, we don't rely even on this. We only eat birds with the tradition. So therefore, it's very important to understand, for Sfardim and Ashkenazim, you need a tradition. The only exception and the only point of disagreement is a bird with webbed feet and a wide beak. Then the Sfardim might rely on the signs. Yes?
Turkey.
Okay. So we'll get to Turkey. We'll get to Turkey in a minute. Yeah, so the Chazon Ish will agree with you that in the time of the Gemara and in the time of the Rishonim, they rely on Simanim. It's a more recent Chumrah. Just like Rashi will tell you, in the time of the Mishnah, they relied on Simanim by birds. Chazon Ish will agree that Rashi relied on Simanim by behemoths. But he says it was an established custom in Lithuania starting in the 17th century, 18th century, whatever it was, and that's now our tradition. But there's no question, they used to rely on signs. Okay. So therefore, we'll get to Turkey hopefully in a minute, but that the halacha has been for 800 years, well, at least Rashi said it 800 years ago, but the halacha, at least since the time of the Shulchan Aruch, that both Ashkenazim and Sfardim need a tradition. Now, what does that mean? What does it mean, a tradition? Well, it meant that if you lived in Poland, in your little town, you had a shochet, and the shochet knew which birds in Poland were kosher, and he taught his student, and the next generation, they knew which birds were kosher. And if you lived in Iraq, so you knew which birds in Iraq were kosher. And your grandmother told you, these are the birds we eat, and these are the birds we don't eat. And every location had their traditions, and they knew what was kosher. And so, for example, in Livorno, Italy, in the mid-1800s, I think it was 1832, a shochet published a book called Zivchei Kohen. Mark talked about this when you were in Livorno, no? What? Yeah, and Mark talks about the birds, no? Because we've introduced him to this book, and he loves it. Okay, so the Zivchei Kohen is a book on the laws of Shechita. In this book, he says, here are the birds that I have a tradition on. And he gives you diagrams, and he even had his students color them in. There are copies with color diagrams of the books that he has the birds that he has a tradition on. 30 birds. And he gives the Italian name, meaning the Latin name, and the Hebrew name, and pictures of the bird. Some of them are unmistakable. What's this bird over here? Peacock. This number 7 is unquestionably a peacock. He clearly had a tradition that peacock was kosher. This is the 1830s. What happened between the 1830s and today? Well, it's very simple. As I said, every town had a shochet. You took a bird, you brought it to the shochet, he shechted it. Every shochet knew every grandmother knew in their town, in their part of the world, which birds are kosher. The guy in Germany knew the German birds, and the guy in Algeria knew the Algerian birds. What happened since then? Two major events have occurred. One is commercialization. Commercialization is, we don't raise birds in our backyard anymore and bring them to the shochet. What do we eat? We eat things that are financially viable, what could be raised commercially and shechted commercially. Which means, it's not only us. You go to McDonald's, they're not serving pheasant and guinea fowl. And what are they serving? They're serving chicken. Why? Because chicken could be easily and quickly raised, and you can make a profit on chicken. So chicken is what's served. You could today have a shochet who has worked for 50 years for Empire and has shechted nothing but chicken. So one thing is the commercialization. The second thing that happens is more or less the ingathering of the exiles. There used to be, if you would have looked at the Jewish map 150 years ago, there were Jewish communities spread throughout Europe, spread throughout North Africa, the Middle East. Where were there no big Jewish communities 150 years ago? North America and the land of Israel. Today, you look at the Jewish map, where are the big communities by far? North America and the land of Israel. How many Jews are left in Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, except Israel, North Africa? Almost nothing. Meaning that all of those traditions from all those other parts of the world are disappearing. And there were no specific traditions regarding birds in North America or regarding birds in the land of Israel. Which means due to commercialization and due to the migration, and really, I guess, you know, the ingathering of the exiles and the moving of the Jews to North America, has resulted in this list of 30 birds that this guy in Italy had coming down to pretty much, you know, if I ask you what birds are kosher, or ask a shochet what he's willing to shech, he'll tell you chicken, turkey, why, hopefully we'll get to, maybe dove, goose, duck, and that's about it. What else is he going to tell you?
Pigeon.
That's about all. This guy here had 30 birds, and Jews all over the place had their local masoras. What did we do? So about, 30 years ago, I learned Shkita, and that's how I got into this. When I was in Yeshiva with my chavrusa, with Ari Greenspan, the dentist, we learned Shkita together. We finished learning Shkita. We did those first 60 simonim of the Shulchan Aruch. And then Ari Greenspan, even though he was in Yeshiva, and he was learning a little bit, but he had a girlfriend. And she was a balas tshuva. And she said, wow, you're now a shochet. Or our parents actually said, you're now a shochet. They were balas tshuva. They said, we remember, we used to eat pheasant. Could you now shecht pheasant for us? We said, I don't know. We only did the first 60 simonim. We didn't get up to pay that. We didn't get up to the laws of birds yet. We said, we'll get back to you on that one. So we went and we started learning the laws about Mesorah and the need for Mesorah. And we realized that there was this problem, that the Mesorahs are disappearing. So let me tell you about turkey in 30 seconds, and then let me tell you about some of the Mesorahs that we found. Why is turkey kosher? Excellent question. Turkey is a North American bird. It would seem to be that there can't be Mesorah on it. It also seems that the Jews started eating it as soon as Columbus discovered America. Columbus came to America, brought turkey back to Europe, and it seems Jews were eating it very quickly because already we find in the 1500s, turkey mentioned in the halachic literature. Not, is it kosher? Why is it kosher? Can we eat it? But a question about treifas, a question relating to the Tzomet Hagidin. So it's clear that they were shechting it. Yet it's only in the 18th century, maybe the late 17th century, that you start getting questions about the kashrus of turkey. But you don't get questions, is it kosher? You get questions of, why is it kosher? Clearly it was widespreadly being eaten. Unfortunately, many of the answers that were given are not satisfactory. They're clearly, you know, they didn't check out the metzios. Sometimes it was very hard to check it out back then. In other words, if you were posik in, you know, the 1820s in Europe, and someone asked you about turkey, you don't really know where the turkey came from. So you give an answer that says, well, turkey is from India, and the Jews of India were eating it, and we're relying on their Mesorah. So some of the answers are very unsatisfactory. The answer that I prefer is the one that the Netziv gave. The Netziv in the late 1800s gave a very nice answer. And he says, why do I eat turkey? Because I have a Mesorah on it. He says, all of Judaism is based on what your parents and teachers told you. You don't question him. It's like the story with Hillel, when the guy comes to Hillel and says, I want you to convert me on the condition that I can be a Kohen Gadol. And Hillel says, no problem. And then they sit down, and he teaches him Aleph, Bet, Gimel. The next day he comes back, and he teaches him Gimel, Bet, Aleph. And the guy said, but yesterday he told me the other way. So Hillel says, well, if you want to learn from me, you're right. You're going to have to trust me. And just like I'm going to tell you this is an Aleph, and there's a Bet, and there's a Gimel, I'm going to tell you also that a Ger can't be a Kohen Gadol, and you're going to have to rely on me. So too, everything we know is tradition from our parents and our teachers. And you can't go back and question where did they get it from and where did they get it from. So the Netziv says, I have a Mesorah on turkey. He says, my father ate turkey and my grandfather ate turkey. He says, if I start to now question where did that Mesorah come from, it's an Ein the Dover Sof. He says, yes, if you had come to me in 1492 and asked me, could you eat turkey, the answer would be, where's it from? North America? There are no Jews there? No, there's no Mesorah. You're coming to me in 1880 and you're asking me, is turkey kosher? Now the burden of proof is on you to show me that it's a predator. And indeed, if you could show me it's a predator, like the story in the Gemara that I skipped, indeed we would have to change our practice and say it's not kosher. But until you do that, the burden of proof is on you, and I have a Mesorah. Because I can't question everything that, you know, how do you know it's an esrog? It's an esrog because your grandfather told you it's an esrog. Everything is tradition in Judaism. Yes?
My parents ate lettuce.
Your parents ate?
Lettuce.
Eat lettuce. So when we made our Mesorah dinner in Yerushalayim, the most recent one in 2010, it's called the Mesorah dinner. We don't call it an exotic food dinner. We call it a Mesorah dinner. And Rav Zev Vitman, who's the posek of Tenuva, spoke about bugs. And he said, if it's a Mesorah dinner, I hope you guys aren't using what's called in Israel Gush Katif lettuce. Because the Mesorah wasn't to use Gush Katif lettuce. And he spoke about, but they did check bugs. When you say that your grandmother ate lettuce, that's true. But if you look in the Halakha Svarim also 200 years ago, they did check for bugs. How and when, and what, that's a question. But there's no question that that was something that, it's not a new thing. We think that maybe it's gone to an extreme. But the halachas from all talk about checking for the bugs. So, but you're correct. The Masorah was to do it a certain way, and gezunt hate. That's the way we should be doing it.
So the first person that ate turkey in Europe...
Maybe was making a mistake. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know why they started eating it. No. They thought it was a big chicken. They thought, whatever it was, it could be they made a mistake. I don't know. I don't know what it was. I don't, but I think it's a very nice answer, and I think it's very important to keep in mind that tradition is very, very important, and that you can't always try to find the source for everything. Yes? What? Well, that's what I said about the swordfish today. That, correct, God doesn't, what he's saying, the Gemara says that the behemoth of a tzaddik doesn't eat non-kosher. Certainly you can't claim that Jews for the last 400 years in huge numbers have been eating a non-kosher bird. In other words, every kosher organization, and I've looked high and low, Ashkenazim and Sfaradim, in the Israel and the Chutzlars, every kosher organization gives hashkacha on turkey. There are individuals who don't eat turkey. The Darkei Tshuva brings that, Darkei Tshuva brings down the famous Frankel family in Russia. This is the early 1900s. That when you marry into the Frankel family, you sign in the ksuva that you're not going to eat turkey. There were some individuals that didn't eat turkey. The descendants of the Shlach claim that he said not to eat turkey and they don't eat turkey. You can't find it in the writings, but they're individuals. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky did not eat turkey. But as an individual thing, Rav David Lifshitz didn't eat turkey, but again, when I talked to his children, they stressed again and again that it was a private chumrah. But every kashrut organization that I've been able to find gives hashkach on turkey. You can't say that the millions of Jews for 400 years have all been eating a non-kosher species. Well, the problem is, you want to say that chicken eats worms, and Tosis brings it up. What's the dories and Tosis is? Okay, I just want to show you one thing because we're way over time. This is the pheasant. Here's the pheasant. When we got that question if we could shecht pheasant for them, we went and we investigated. We found a fascinating article by Professor Yehuda Felix. He's well known for flora and fauna in the Bible and in the Mishnah. And he wrote an article in the first volume of Tchumen where he traces the history of the word pasyon, a pheasant in Hebrew. He shows that it's in the Gemara, it's in the Midrashim, it's in the Rishonim. He's able to show that pasyon was a kosher bird from the time of the Gemara until the early 20th century. But how do I know the pasyon in the Gemara and the pasyon in the Oruch and the pasyon up to Rav David Tzvi Hoffman is the same bird that I call a pasyon? You need a living tradition. And he couldn't find a living link. So we came back to this girl's parents and we said, sorry, we think that pheasant is kosher, but we don't have the living link. And we went back to the Beis Medrash, and then we happened to overhear a friend talking about that he was in the Beis Din of Rav Yosef Kapach. He goes once a week to the heir of Kapach. He was sort of the leader of the Yemenite Jews in Yerushalayim. And he goes to his Beis Din to hear the questions every week. And that week, this guy doesn't know we're listening. He's talking to another friend. He says, that week Rav Kapach had a question about pheasant. And Rav Kapach said, sure, we have a tradition that in Yemen, pheasant was treated as kosher. And so we tackled the guy in the Beis Medrash, and we said, take us to your leader. And he took us to Rav Kapach, and we said to Rav Kapach, do you have a Masorah on pheasant? He said, absolutely. But how do I know what you call pheasant? That's what I call pheasant. Bring me some pheasants. No problem. Two stupid American kids in yeshiva, we go off to the biblical zoo, we asked if they have any pheasants, they said, sure. We said, we could buy some. They said, why? We said, we want to shecht them, and they showed us the exit. So we eventually found a few pheasants. We brought them to Rav Kapach. Here's Ari Greenspan, before he was a dentist, when he used to wear funny glasses, shechting a pheasant in front of Rav Kapach. And then Rav Kapach shechted one. And then Rav Kapach gave us his letter, where he said that Arya Yosef ben Rav Anshel Mordechai, that's Greenspan, and Ari Tzvi ben Dov Zivatovsky, that's me, the two of them from America, brought in front of me the pheasant that's called in Arabic to this and in Teman this, that I know is a kosher bird. It has the signs of a kosher bird. The Yeshlanu bo Mesorit, we have a tradition that it's a kosher bird. And I'm signing here that I've showed them that it's a kosher bird. See, here we have a living Mesorah. That's what it means, a Mesorah. You go to Rav Kapach, you go to a person, and it doesn't have to be Rav Kapach. It could be anybody's grandmother. It could be anybody who is able to identify the bird. It has to be the live bird. It can't be on a schnitzel on a plate. You know, identify the bird. And tell you that this is a kosher bird. And indeed, we got this letter from Rav Kapach, and it was amazing, because in our research, we've seen Professor Felix's article, we also saw Rav Moshe Feinstein had a tshuva. Rav Moshe Feinstein, the unquestioned posek of American Jewry, Rav Moshe had a question about the kashrus of the pheasant, and he says, I can't find the Masorah on it, therefore you have to treat it as non-kosher. Now, this was in the 1970s when he wrote that. There was no internet. There was no way for him to, you know, search to find somebody. And he actually, Rabbi Tendler told us that Moshe had sent him to go out and see if he could find anybody. He couldn't find the Masorah, and he says you have to treat it as a non-kosher bird. And here we had this Masorah from Rav Kapach. Now, unfortunately, by the time we got around, we were, you know, tzitzering, you know, we could write to Rav Moshe, you know. By the time we finally wrote to him, Rav Moshe was sick, and then we got back a letter from his secretary, Rabbi Tendler's son, Rav Moshe's grandson, who said, Rav Moshe already wrote a tshuva about it, it's not kosher, you need an oral and a visual Masorah, and we don't have one. So we wrote back, we said, no, but we do. That's what we wrote to you about. And by the time he got that letter, it was already too late, and Rav Moshe wasn't able to respond. When Rav Tendler, years later, heard the story and saw the letters, I won't tell you what language he used about his son, but he says there's no question in his mind that Rav Moshe would have permitted it if he had the evidence that we have. And Rav Tendler then came to our first dinner in 2002, and indeed, he ate pheasant with us. We went around, okay, there are a lot of other stories, we're not going to have time for that, but we went around looking for people with Masorah. In this case, it's mostly Sfaradim, because the Ashkenazim Shochtim, by the time we're looking, think, an Ashkenazi Shochet, who last Shechted in Romania in 1939, by the time we're looking in 1999, is a very old man, if they exist at all. The Sfaradim left Morocco and Algeria throughout the 50s and even the 60s, so we were able to find Shochtim from North Africa who still had Masorahs. This guy actually is not North Africa. This guy is from Kurdistan. And we brought him this stuffed bird, and he told us he has a Masorah. We brought it to this guy. He also did. He sent, gave us a letter. We brought him. Muscovy is a long story. Muscovy is, we're skipping because it's too long a story. But if you want, you can read the article on it. Anyhow, what we have done is we've gone from old Shoichet to old Shoichet and collected Masorahs that we could find. We then have these dinners where we serve them, and at the dinners, we not only serve them, we have a mini shear on each topic, and we try to also present live birds, because again, if you want to transmit the Masorah, it's important that they be birds. So that's the story on kosher birds.
What birds do you have?
That we have found Masorahs on is pheasant, guinea fowl, and partridge, quail, some of them, and we worked with the OU on a lot of this. And the quail that we have, they're willing to accept. Some of the partridges, the different kind of partridge, they're willing to accept. So far, pheasant and guinea fowl, they're not willing to accept.
What was that bird?
Which, this over here is a partridge. These are partridges that I'm showing you here. All of these. I don't have the guinea fowl here. No, I didn't. Okay. And the Muscovy is a separate story. We'll have to get into another time. Okay. But I think it's...
glad he's not a vegetarian. Okay.
Yeah. Listen, if there are any vegetarians, I have no problem. If one wants to be a vegetarian, that's fine. All that we're doing is we want to preserve the traditions. These and food traditions are an integral part of a culture. And, you know, if a person wants to be a vegetarian, it's fine. As long as you don't insist that the Torah says that you should be a vegetarian. This guy Schwartz in Staten Island, the president of the North American Jewish Vegetarians, when he claims that Torah tells you that you have to be a vegetarian, that's when I have a problem. If he wants to be a vegetarian, gesundheit. But, okay.
Okay, thank you very much.